Hi, my name is Alex. I'm a person with a disability. I'm a self-advocate and I'm proud of it. And on this day, the 3rd of December, which is International Day of People with Disability, I'm calling on all people with disability, especially those with an intellectual disability, to stand up and be counted.
On 3rd of December, International Disability, on the Big Bowl Breakfast, we are very pleased to announce that we have got the Mayor of Strathbogie Council on the line, Colleen Filinato. Hello, Colleen.
Hello, how are you, Raphael?
I'm very well now. Is that one of the things we'd like to talk about is that I believe that you're also the winner of the Brenda Gabe Award in 2015. Would you like to tell the Big Bowl Breakfast and all our listeners what it's about?
Yes, the Brenda Gabe Award was named after done in honour of Brenda Gabe, who was a woman with a disability, and who worked tirelessly for women with disabilities, but also people with a disability across the board, I suppose. But she was extremely passionate and was very closely linked to Women's Disability Victoria, and her work was very respected. And in particular, I share her what was her passion and real focus on advocacy in the prevention of violence against women. And I work in that area a lot through council and in my community. And yes, I was this year's recipient. It's in its third year, and I was absolutely honoured to be chosen out of a magnificent bunch of women who I was in awe of myself, and to be named the winner this year was an absolute privilege and an honour.
Well, it certainly was, and I believe that you were also nominated for the Brenda Gabe Award in 2014 as well.
I actually was nominated in all 3 years, so the 2013, 14, and then 15, and so privileged. And it was by different organisations and different people, so it was very humbling to be nominated by various organisations and different avenues, with people valuing my work, and that in itself is an absolute award. And but to officially win the award this year and be the 2015 awardee was an absolute thrill, a big shock and an absolute thrill.
Well, let's go back. Is that for around 20 years you worked around Allied Health? Can you please tell us about International Disability and Allied Health? What part of health were you working around? Wasn't it nursing?
Yes, I was nursing, and prior to doing my nursing training, which I did later in life, I did it once I had my family, and worked with a local health facility here in a small town called Euroa in country Victoria, and also worked at Golden Valley Health, which is in Shepparton. And when I was working as the Allied Health Assistant, I was basically assisting the physiotherapist within an aged care facility. But in our aged care facility, we, over the time, have had younger people with disability, not necessarily the age sector, but because there's very limited place for people, young people with a disability, to be cared for regionally, there was the placement of some younger people in the aged care facility where I worked, and it was part of my job was to try to make sure that they were there, needs were being individually met, as they may not have, didn't really fit into the total aged care entertainment, as well as exercises, as well as interaction. So I had the privilege of being able to do a lot more one-to-one with those residents. And I found through the act of physiotherapy and diversional therapy, anything that I could do to try to add to the day of people within the facility was a huge delight. And it involved cooking and it involved outings and trying to be as normal as possible, but while still needing that time of care. So that was pretty much my Allied Health role. I was instrumental in one of the first schools of therapy rooms, which is basically a tactile or all senses stimulating special room with light, tactile, different surfaces and massage therapy. I've been a massage therapist for about 30 years. So embodying all those things into trying to improve the life and individuality of people with a disability in that facility and beyond. And I've worked in that area for quite some time and then became a nurse. And I've been in the health field for quite some time. And I myself have an MS illness going along, which I'm relatively a newbie to the disability world. I've only been having the effects of that starting over the last 10 years or so. And I'm now in an electric wheelchair. So I'm extremely blessed that my disability doesn't hold me back. And I've been absolutely thrilled to have been able to be elected into local government when I couldn't nurse anymore and really wanted to work and advocate for our healthcare in our rural community. And I've been able to do that being a councillor and now the privilege of being mayor of our shire.
Yes, and with part of your journey that from working around health, then there was the career change, and after some discussion with your family, you decide to move into local council. Were they supportive of your decision?
Absolutely. I was actually tapped on the shoulder and asked by several people within our shire to would I consider running for local government. And so my family and I got our campaign plan together, and with a whole budget, I think, of $500, we printed off flyers and dropped them in everybody's mailbox in town, and I just tried to be the normal me. I was also working for the local doctor surgery at the time as a phlebotomist, and so I was known in the community, I suppose, and I think through my nursing I was trusted because the nursing fraternity in rural communities there's a lot of trust required for our good nursing that we've done. And so my family were excellent. We lobbied up and worked hard, and to all our surprise, we weren't expecting that I would get in the first time that I tried, but I did. And so then it was a matter of, okay, goodness, what do we do now over the next 4 years? And but we quickly, together with the support of my family, got into that role and have been really blessed to have worked within my community with staff that live in our community for our community. So been pretty much a dream role, really.
What does it mean to be a leader in disability, Colleen?
Well, to me, a leader in disability, I think I like to not focus totally on that I have a disability, because I think it would be wonderful if disability was just thought as mainstream. And while it's wonderful that people talk about my achievements as a person with a disability, and but I would like to think that as a leader, because I have the opportunity, because I have the support, because I have the drive and passion of commitment, and I was brought up in my family that if you see something that needs doing, get on and do it. So I probably didn't officially see myself as a leader until the formal election, I suppose, of my first term in council. But I think to be a leader, showing what can be done, and bringing the issues of people from all areas of demographic, as well as from older, younger, being a young mum and a young business, that required leadership in that area, so advocating for what we needed along the way. But for me, a disability advocate or a disability leader, or person with a disability, I'm a woman first, and I just happen to have a disability, and I'm actually very blessed in a way that I have that disability, because it's made me look at life a lot different than what I probably would have. And I probably had a bit more I'll have a go attitude, and also it comes with the commitment of that I am able to get myself around, and I can articulate myself reasonably well, but I have a role in that I'm supported by my family and that I can do all these things physically and emotionally and confidently, that I think it's essential that those that can be leaders in disability support others who might need a little bit more mentoring or a little bit more encouragement for people with disability.
Now, is it in the whole community, is that violence is a big problem, especially women We are calling. He has just come off the line. He will try to get her back on the line as soon as possible. Now, what we're going to talk about is internet. No.
Turn off the radio.
You're listening to 3CR 855 AM on International Day of People with a Disability.
For people with disabilities all around the world to have their say and be able to stand up for their rights and also should be given a try at new skills and knowledge, and we're all out there and we've got abilities to do things in the all we need is people to take off their horse glasses and see us.
Hi, this is Gary. You're listening to 3CR and we're celebrating International Day of Disability.
Australia has to do better for Aboriginal people with disabilities. Australia has to do better for women with disabilities. Australia must close institutions that are still open, and people in children's workshops are paid unfair wage. That must stop now. Nothing about us without us.
We would like to welcome Colleen back on the line. Okay, Colleen. Right. Okay, what I was going to ask you is that Strathbogie Council recently initiated a plan about violence against women, and it was made into the part of the council plan.
Yes, that's right. We've started our, in about 2009, we started working on, with really small steps, but with commitment and with the advocacy role that I was taking on with the sort of unofficial portfolios, I suppose, in council of healthcare and wellbeing, and prevention of violence is something that happens in all communities, and rural communities are particularly challenged in what services there are available to help people in these situations, and we needed to raise awareness. So our CEO, who is still our current CEO, was absolutely magnificent in supporting and becoming a White Ribbon Ambassador. We started to develop in some plans and policy about when we talk in our health and wellbeing plan, for example, we talk about, advocating for services, but we wanted to drill down to that a little bit and be a bit more specific, and we wanted that to support prevention of violence against women and children initiatives and focusing on the prevention area, as well as we needed to make sure that we have services for those experiencing violence. But we felt that it was really important in council's role from, young children in our infant welfare centres right through to school age into the aged care sector, that we needed to be raising awareness that this is an issue and reminding people that violence against women and children is not only physical forms of violence. It's violence in withdrawal of privilege, power and control, and things that which a lot of work that I've done with Women's Disability Victoria also have identified what people might not have normally thought was actually violence. It was making people not feel safe in their own home, and council felt it was important to have in policy and in led by a CEO who was the first CEO in the state, I believe, to have prevention of violence against women and children KPIs in his contract. And I think that he has shown and led operations of council very well in that regard, and extremely proud of him for that. And so slowly over the years we've been able to be involved more and get into more in-depth advocacy and good policy around accessibility, and having that from everywhere from our assets and infrastructure, our engineers thinking about that when we're changing access to buildings or when we're building new buildings, that we're thinking about accessibility. I mean, it should be just, shouldn't just be the building regulations to code, just, you know, without considering disability and access and thinking a little bit further, thinking a bit down the track about what might be needed in the community. And we have a largely aged community, but we do have a high level of people with varying disabilities, and we need to be catering for our own community, but we need to have facilities that were, that are and will be of use and be great for our tourism, in having facilities for people to come and visit and live, work and invest in our shire. So we felt that these things can only happen if we have the policy.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Colleen. It's been very, very interesting talking to you. We'd like to thank Colleen Fanato for your time. Thank you very much, Colleen, for appearing on the Big Bold Breakfast for your time.
My pleasure, and I wish everybody a very talk festive International Day of Disability, and I know that the next year will be even better than the last.
Thank you very much. That was Colleen Fanato, the Mayor of Strathbogie Council.
The Front Page, where 3CR Breakfast explores what's being reported and what's not in Australia's mainstream media. How the media prioritise the day's news, including issues of bias, corporate influence and who gets a voice and who doesn't. Monday to Friday at 7am and again at 8am. A critical analysis of the nation's newspapers.
Well, seeing that there was very little covered in the mainstream news today on International Day of the Disability, let's go back and revisit some of the things that was disability news, such as in January 2015, Leslie Hall was awarded a posthumous Order of Australia, which is absolutely fantastic, but maybe they would like to actually recognise people while they're actually about at the same time too.
That's what you're not looking forward to your posthumous award then?
No, clearly Raphael does not want a posthumous awards. So anyone looking...
Any awards we want them today.
Yeah, anyone that does want to give Daniel an... I don't know who Daniel is. Anyone that wants to give Raphael an award, today... Obviously, now is the time whilst he's here to enjoy it.
Well, it's kind of like it's because having a disability, it's like being on call 24/7. It's very similar to being a prime minister, I think, but there's no minister of disability for me to take this up with.
Now, just before...
Where are my dot points?
Yes, that's it. Before you... actually, good point you raised there about awards, Daniel. Raphael. We should just quickly mention that a couple of other... notable women in the disability sector have won awards at the National Disability Awards in Canberra recently, and they were Karen Howe, the CEO of Women with Disabilities Victoria, for her tireless efforts working with women with disabilities on a number of issues for a number of years. So, well done and well deserved,
yay,
Karen.
Yay!
Crowd goes wild, and also Julie Phillips,
yes,
who is a disability advocate, also won an Excellence in Advocacy Award, which again is well deserved for her tireless disability advocacy, and she's still advocating away, and we've interviewed her a number of times, yeah, on the boldness around various issues.
So for people who don't know, Julie runs the Disability Discrimination Legal Service.
Yes.
And as you say, she is just amazing. She works so hard. She's highlighted so many issues of children being restrained in school, no access to education, all sorts of stuff that's going on.
Indeed. And Julie is a very humble person and would I'm sure say there are a number of advocates out there who do amazing work, and that's true, but Julie also deserves to be recognised as one of those people who does amazing and tireless work. So well done, Julie.
And Raphael, you mentioned there's absolutely no coverage in the mainstream news today in the broadsheets, but what else happened this year that we think was good or bad?
Well, one of the most important ones, too, is that in April 2015, Anglicare released a 2015 rental affordability snapshot showing that less than 2% of rental properties is affordable for people with a disability, and in the metropolitan areas, that was just 51 of 51,000 properties. Fantastic. There's only 20% of people with disability in the community, but we get less than 1% of affordable housing. Fantastic.
Yes, my box on the side of the road is looking very...
Is it an accessible box?
Well, you've got a box.
Looking very comfortable.
I've got a sheet.
We're about to just, before we descend into the four Yorkshiremen sketch from Monty Python, I think it does highlight that people with disabilities can't afford the rental market, and sadly, there's really not commitment from government or private developers or partnerships to make more disability housing, and also for people living in who happen to live in nursing homes or with complex care needs, they
did you just descend into euphemism?
No, I'm sorry, I did too. There's a lack of housing for them too, which needs to be explored.
Well, is that one of those things that? It's a big, important story that came out in March 2015.
It did.
There was the National Ethnic Disability Alliance and Down Syndrome Australia expressed concerns about Australia denying a visa for the Fineska family from Sri Lanka because their daughter, Eliza, has Down syndrome.
Yes.
That's true. But when we just had a big interview about something like this, it's only a voluntary commitment.
And
it's amazing.
And also, and sadly, Daniel... Sadly, Raphael, that still happens. That's happened as well recently. Again, a woman from Costa Rica wanted to bring her mother, and she's living here in Australia and is a permanent resident, and wanted to bring her mother and her brother out here. Her mother was granted a visa, but her brother, who has Down syndrome, was not, and so they had to pay all these fees and airline tickets, and that's all gone down the drain because people wouldn't let this person in. Plus, we've had recently a doctor as well over Western Australia who's helping people with disabilities settle here in this. Migrants with disabilities and refugees settle here in Australia has also had his visa also having his visa looked in with the possibility of being deported. I'm not quite sure what's happened with that, but I mean it's pretty terrible. Again, our treatment of asylum seekers and.
Do you think there was a kind of a slogan we never heard about called "Turn Back the Disabled"?
Yes, that's not a bad. I'm sure Tony Abbott would have used that.
I think it predates Tony Abbott by a long way.
He would have gone with it.
He would have.
I think the Migration Act needs to change because I think that's from. About 1958 or something, and it doesn't its view of disability being a burden to the taxpayer it needs to really be reconsidered, and it's sadly, I mean, people have been talking about this, but nothing's actually ever happened.
No, I think if you apply, even if you've managed to get a visa, and then if you're eligible then to apply for citizenship, you still have to tick a separate box saying that you are disabled, and even if you've been living here for decades.
Well, I mean, even people who can demonstrate that they work, that they're competent enough to work, also struggle to get in or can demonstrate that they're not a burden to the taxpayer, that they have a level of independence, struggle with migrating here, which is a terrible thing.
And lastly, with the news on International Day of Disability, there was the film The Martian that was released I think that having a disability, I find it sometimes a bit like being an alien. NASA's going to actually maybe send something across to Mars and colonise it.
Do we need our own planet?
I wonder if they're going to actually get affordable housing up there too.
Well,
we should design a planet. We should.
Crip world.
Like Atlantis, maybe.
That is so going to be in some kind of app or game by the end of the day.
Yeah, there'll be a meme or something, app or someone will... Crip world, yeah, I can see the.
All right,
I'd like to let's colonize Crip world.
All right, we'll be back in after a song, and we'll have our next guest, who
is Catherine Anear.
Catherine Anear, who? Where's Catherine from?
Catherine is from, well, many places, but one of them is the Autism Self Advocacy Network of Australia.
Fantastic.
8:55 a.m. on International Day of persons with what they call it disabilities. I don't.
Now, it's that the boldness is about standing up for your rights for if you've got a disability, instead of waiting for some well-meaning person to give them to you. That's why we played "These Boots Are Made for Walking All Over You" by the Bear Brass Asylum Orchestra.
That would be the Bear Brass Asylum Orchestra, but nicely played, Raphael.
Thank you, Finn.
I may as well introduce our next guest, who's online. It's Catherine Anear from the Autistic Self Advocacy Network Australia. Sorry about that, Catherine. How are you this morning?
Good morning, Finn. I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. I'm just trying to get my teeth back in now. Now, to ask some difficult questions for you to begin with, just because of their unpleasant nature. Recently, there has been deaths and restraining of autistic people is there ever really a case for ever really a need or can we put a case? Can anyone ever put a case forward that is the right thing to do?
No, is the short answer. The number of cases in which we've learned about people being restrained unnecessarily or, in fact, dying from abuse and neglect, it has risen. I think, unfortunately, the cases are coming to light now because it's kind of like an avalanche of information that we're hearing because the media has picked up on it. Unfortunately, they've always been happening. It's just that there's been a bit of a media craze lately in terms of if something happens to an autistic person, it's being reported upon. Unfortunately, it keeps happening and has always happened. And, there's no, obviously no, I guess, justification for this kind of restraint and abuse. And unfortunately, this morning we've seen more information about another case being published in the Adelaide Advertiser, talking about an early intervention centre in South Australia run by AEIOU, where it's alleged that two children have been bruised while being restrained in some kind of toilet training exercise. And the Child Protection Services in South Australia have confirmed in the case of one child who was able to give some evidence to them that abuse has occurred. So even though the centre is vehemently defending themselves and denying anything has happened, we can pretty much, safely say that it has because of the track record of many centres that claim to care for autistic people.
Why has this been allowed to go on for so long, do you think?
I think I wrote a piece not long ago in where I kind of alerted people to the fact that I think people fear autism. People fear the unknown and they fear autism, therefore they fear autistic people and think that autism and autistic behaviour is something that needs desperately to be controlled in some way or normalised. I mean, in the case of the AEIOU centre that we're just starting to hear about, it was, aiming at correcting or normalising the children's behaviour or producing a more typical behaviour that led these staff to allegedly abuse the children. So, I think there's no reason for any child, to be restrained while toilet training or bruised while toilet training. If it happened to a typical child, there'd be absolute outrage. But for some reason, it's okay because we're trying to normalise an autistic child. So people justify things because they fear what they see as abnormal. And many people have argued that there's not enough support for autistic people and families of autistic people. And that's something that I and we as the Autistic Self Advocacy Network don't deny. There isn't enough support for autistic people and their families, but none of that justifies abusing and restraining autistic people.
How should autistic people be treated?
Well, there are a number of ways of de-escalating a situation in which someone is very distressed, and obviously physically restraining them is not a go-to method that we would condone, but supporting people who have behaviours that arise through, you know, distressing environments and them not being able to communicate or understand the world as a typical person would, you know, we need to approach that as, you know, with the adage that behaviour is communication. So if someone is distressed, we need to work out what's going on in their environment, how we can assist them by helping them to communicate better, how we can assist them by changing their environment. And this is where, you know, we need the extra support for people to be able to have the support to learn about assisting someone with their behaviour. But also I think we need to put a stop to the idea that that somehow autism can be trained out of a child through, you know, repeated interventions aimed to normalise, because there's two things at play here. One is restraining a child or a young person or an adult when their behaviour is seemingly, you know, out of control, or seemingly, you know, having them at risk to themselves or others. In those situations, we need to start helping that person de-escalate and manage their behaviour well before it comes to that flashing point. And that requires more resources, better understanding of what has led to that behaviour in the first place, and much better communication support for autistic people, because a lot of this is underlying, you know, communication frustration. But the second point, you know, is the intense desire to normalise, you know, and you know, restraining a child. Again, I'll come back to the latest example. Restraining a child in order for them to learn to go to the toilet is not on.
No, it isn't. But it seems that the voice of autistic people has been lost in every aspect of this, particularly in terms of the treatment of autistic people, but also in the media regarding mistreatment or alleged malpractice of centres. And also, in worst case scenarios, deaths of autistic folk as a result of mistreatment. Why aren't we hearing autistic voices?
Well, that's a really good question, Finn. Why aren't we hearing autistic voices? We don't know. We could suppose that people don't know that autistic adults exist and that can speak for themselves and communicate in a range of ways. Like, I happen to be a, as you might have noticed, very verbal autistic person. And there are a number of people, you know, who are capable of talking about these situations and representing autistic people. Obviously, Autistic Self-Advocacy Network is made up of a board of people who can tell their put across their opinions and represent other people. We also have a fairly vast membership across all states of Australia and New Zealand. So lots of people being supported to, you know, find their voice. And for us, you know, principally we do what we call systemic advocacy, so challenging the system, but also commenting on commenting quite a lot lately on cases like this. The go-to groups seem to be the parents, who seem to have the loudest voices at the moment. What we need, I think, is for the parents to defer to us and say, actually, you know, perhaps you might like to talk to some autistic people. It comes down to power, Finn, and who has the power. At the moment, autistic people don't have the power in the voice for themselves, and other people are not willing to share that power. And because of the nature of the communication impairments of many autistic people, they never get a chance to speak up. And I think the assumption is that, you know, we just won't hear autistic voices. And the media, I think, believe that assumption in the stereotype that people can't communicate, but even those who don't have verbal speech have other reliable means of communication, and we know that, you know, many people communicate in other ways. So to say that we have nothing to say, or to assume that we have nothing to say, is really poor on behalf of the media and those other organisations who I guess take the spotlight away from the autistic voice.
Well, we hope today that, Catherine, that we, in our own little small way on 3CR and also the boldness in the Big Bold Breakfast, that we've been able to provide a platform to hear the autistic voice. Thanks for joining us today, Catherine.
Not a problem, Finn. Thank you very much for having me on this particular day. And, I'm off to do some other things.
Fantastic. Well, happy Disability Day to you. And thanks very much for joining us. Catherine Anea, co-founder of the Self-Advocacy Network of Australia.
Disability Day on 3CR, 12 hours of community radio by, for and about people with disability.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.